Pasuk Vav, starting from Pasuk Vav. And there is always a discussion to be had about whether the Arayos fall to the category of a Chok or not. The Ramban has a discussion over here that the Arayos essentially are a Chok. This is something that we know only because the Kadosh Baruch Hu tells us. But we try to still figure out what they're about. And that's where we find that Rosham Shemfal Hirsch, for example, has a lot to say about theorizing what exactly is the message of these Yisuri Arayos, while also commenting that we can't know all of it. We don't know the whole picture. We just have the ability to try to speculate a little bit as to what exactly is the message. The question of whether it's a choker or something else is relevant also to a topic I think we mentioned in the past. The Rambam in Shmona Prakim has a statement that there's a distinction to be drawn between mitzvos where we understand what they're about and mitzvos where we don't understand what they're about, as far as the question of, is it necessary for us to develop personalities that are in sync with the mitzvos HaTorah? So the passage that the Yalkut Shimoni has and other sources have, that we say that there's no mitzvah for a person to say, I'm not interested in eating treif, I find it disgusting. It's fine for a person to live 120 years and say that the treif food is very appealing, but what can I do? Ratzon havoreh, I'm not allowed to. Gzeiras hamelech. So the Rambam has a distinction that that's true only when it comes to the chukim, what we don't understand. So then, all right, we don't know what it's about anyway, so it's fine to live a whole life and say that I still want to do this, but I won't simply because of Gzeiras HaMelech. But when it comes to the mishpatim that we do understand, so we're supposed to try to create personalities that are in sync. So where do Arayos fit into this? So that's also a discussion. We find there around them and elsewhere, Arayos are a little bit of a borderline category. Is this something that we treat as a chok? Is this something that we treat as more accessible intellectually? And that's a little bit of a discussion. So Rosham Shemfal Hirsch over here notes that the language of Legalos Erba, specifically this this focus on revealing nakedness, he notes that that's not only the literal happening, but that that's also the term, because the whole point is that the person is exposed in an animalistic fashion, that this activity is considered to be bestial nature, the way he puts it. And here, in this sense, it's very synergistic to our whole Masechta. He says that the relationships between people are meant to be directed towards the exalted goal of marriage, our Masechta Kiddushin, and our whole theme about the kinyan that creates the seriousness and sanctification to that relationship. So it's only that which is consistent without possibility that is a legitimate relationship, and anything that is outside the possibility of marriage is not. And he then goes on to discuss that the idea that relatives are excluded, and here in Parshas Achrimos the focus is more on the relatives, and Parshas Kedoshim he notes that when it's a restatement of the Yisuri Arayos, so there the focus is more on relationships created by marriage, and how the sanctity of marriage is the theme there. And here, first, the idea we open with is the nature of family relationships and how those are prohibited as far as Arayos are concerned. So he notes that the Torah said, Al kein yazov ish esavi v'yasimo, that the whole idea of marriage is that one is supposed to leave his family, is supposed to go to another entity. And this is, again, a crucial part of a moral society. He notes that in the context of the Mabul, so the descent into complete irredeemable immorality begins with the idea that's expressed there of a chulahem nashim yikol asher bacharu, that they just picked whatever they want. There was no discipline, there was no discrimination in terms of how to go about in their relationships. So that's the problem, and here our parsha is instructing us the opposite, and he has this idea that it should be the love of the bond of marriage that is the complete definition of the relationship, and the love of relatives should not be mixed in. It shouldn't come from an affection that one feels because they are blood relatives, it should come purely from the connecting and coming together in marriage. Now, that's an interesting idea. We have to figure out a little bit, because the truth is we do have some mixed messages a little bit. So we know, for example, the Gemara says in Yevamos that it's appropriate and recommended for a man to marry his niece. There are some dinim in Arayos that are a little bit hard to understand. So a aunt is not allowed to marry her nephew, but an uncle is allowed to marry his niece. And not only that, but an uncle is encouraged to marry his niece, because the assumption is that he will have a greater care for her because of his love for his brother. So I don't know exactly how that fits with what Rav Hirsch said here, where he's saying it's bad for there to be any mixture of any family affection. It should be purely the marital affection. And there, that didn't seem to suggest that there's some advantage to there being some type of familial concern. So that's a little bit of a detail we need to try to work out. But in any event, so this is a part of what we find here, that there is exclusion of relatives from marriage. And of course, she goes on to say that a sister can't be a wife at the same time. If she's a wife, she's not a sister. If she's a sister, she's not a wife. And these relationships are mutually exclusive, and each one needs to have its distinct space. And that's a big part of the message here. If you remember correctly, the Meshech Chachma writes that when the Torah prohibits marrying one sister, it's because the whole nature of marriage is also meant to diversify one's perspective, and that one would, perhaps al pi derech hateva, have a tendency to want to marry their close relatives, and therefore the Torah has to say, no, you have to diversify, and you have to be told that you're not allowed to do that. Now again, that idea also has to be reconciled with the idea that we assume that by Teva people don't normally have a Yetzirah for their close relatives, and they don't want to marry their close relatives. So again, there's a lot of ideas here that we have to straighten out. The Gemara says that actually Chazal davened for that Yetzirah to disappear. So of course Chazal davened that there should be no interest in Arayis at all, and no interest in Bi at all, and then the world essentially stopped moving. There was no progress, there was nothing functioning anymore. So they brought that back, but they still had some impact in that people don't have a taiva for their close relatives. So again, there's a lot that we have to try to work out in order to have a coherent theory. So it goes again to this question that we started with: are the arayos a chok? Are the arayos something that we do understand? It seems like it kind of occupies a little bit of the middle space. A lot of details that require a little bit more thought, and a lot that we can relate to as far as having an orderly and sanctified and disciplined society. This, of course, is read on Yom Kippur, the Parshas HaArayos. It's a big discussion why. The Moshe Zakenim suggests that it is meant to be symbolic, that we're talking about the embarrassment and disgrace that comes from Gilui HaArayos. So we're asking Kadosh Baruch Hu to have Rachmanos on us. Please don't be Megala HaArayos, so to speak. Don't leave us exposed, but rather have Rachmanos on us. Rav Schwab has a comment which I'm not sure how it matches up with reality necessarily. Rav Schwab says that maybe the point is that these averus were not so commonly violated, and therefore it's a little bit of a limud zchus. We're saying, okay, we're being misvad all our averus on Yom Kippur, so we don't want to look like we violated everything, so let's mention some averus that we haven't violated. Again, you have to figure out how much that works. Others have suggested that it's simply that on the day of Kiddusha, the day where we abstain from eating and drinking, where we are focused on an angelic-like existence, it makes sense also that this is a part of the element of what it means to be Kodesh, and therefore we emphasize as well that that's something that we have to be aware of. We also find in general references in Shas to the idea that we're worried about the Sahara on Yom Kippur. It seems a little striking, because you might think, okay, Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur. Well, if any day you're not going to be so susceptible to the Sahara, you think Yom Kippur is it. But yeah, we find that, no, that there's some kind of a parallel reaction, and that as holy as the day is, that sometimes is associated with an even greater pull towards other things. So maybe there's a greater need to counteract that, and that's what leads to this meeting. Zedidiah.
Isn't there an idea that Yitzhar is taken away in Yom Kippur? Isn't that
Yeah, is that true?
Yeah, feel like I've heard it before.
Yeah, it could be. That would be nice. But we find a couple of indications in Chazal that there is a parallel force, and that there is sometimes an even greater need to worry about the Yetzirah and Kippur. So an interesting concept in and of itself. So this pasuk also contains the term lo sikruvu, that not only is one not allowed to be megala erva, but one also cannot approach the matter. One shouldn't come close to it. So what does that mean, to come close to it? So this is a topic of a very well-known machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban. This is a topic that high school students ask about most often, perhaps, and it's been given a different name. It's been known as the Issur Negiyah. The Issur Negiyah is really a term in Hilchos Tumah Vetarah and maybe other contexts. And the Rishonim, this is called Hiskarvus L'Arayus, or Chibuk Menishuk L'Arayus. And it's a topic of a major machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban. And the Rambam says that we see from a pasuk like this that there is an Isser D'Arayso to be involved in even approaching Gilui Arayus. So therefore, that which is on the way is also prohibited. That's what this pasuk is conveying. And therefore, the Rambam says that there is a onesh of malchus associated with it because it is an instrument ha-Torah. And the Ramban disagrees. The Rambam says his position both in the Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Yisuri Biyah, in Perek Chaf Aleph, Halach Aleph. It's also in the Sefer HaMitzvos in Shin Chav Gimel. So over there, the Ramban disagrees, and the Ramban has a two-tiered disagreement. He says he doesn't think that this is an Issur D'Araisa. He thinks that it's an Issur D'Rabbanan. And even were it to be an Issur D'Araisa, he doesn't think it's the kind that gets Malkus. And in that context, he invokes the term Chatzi Shir. So that, just parenthetically, that led to a whole discussion. Because we talk about Chatzi Shir in the Gemara, where let's say somebody's eating chazer, eating chametz on Pesach. So he's only chayiv if he eats a kezayis. So let's say he eats less than a kezayis. So the Gemara says, even though there's no onesh, you're still prohibited from having a chatzi zayis, or anything less than a kezayis, because of this din of chatzi shir. So when the Ramban invokes the phrase chatzi shir in this context, so many achronim pounced on that and said, oh, what do you see here? That there is a fascinating concept here. We have a chatzi shir bekamus. There's such a thing as a chatzi shir in quantity. And there's also a chatzi shir be'echus. That there's also such a thing as a qualitative chatzi shir, where it's not that we're measuring anything, but you're just on the way to the avera. So that's also called an isser chatzi shir. And this discussion has been applied to many other things. So I'm not sure if that's really what the Ramban means. I think the Ramban might just be invoking the idea of Chatzi Shir just to give an example of the fact that even if you want to say it's an Isser D'Araisa, it doesn't mean that there's going to be a Chi of Malkus. It doesn't mean there's going to be an Onesh. Because there is such a thing as an Isser D'Araisa that doesn't rise to the level of an onesh. And Chatzi Shir is emblematic of that. The whole point of Chatzi Shir is it's the Isser without the onesh. That even though we're below the threshold for the onesh, there still could be an Isser. So I think his point is that when it comes to this, even if the Rambam is right, and it's an Isser D'Araisa, it still doesn't have to mean there's an onesh associated. It's possible to have the Isser without the onesh. But in any event, this was the major machlokus between them, and it's a big discussion how to apply this. The Avestor of Nassim, I think we mentioned this in other contexts. So this, if the Rambam is right, so this is essentially a Siag D'Araisa, a topic that seems to come up every other week somehow. So the idea that the Torah creates prohibitions that are themselves safeguards and protective measures for other prohibitions. So as we've noted, there are many possible instances of this. So it would seem like if the Rambam is correct, that this is another one, that this is an Isser D'Araisa that's there to prevent another Isser D'Araisa. And that's interesting. Also, the truth is, there's an Avestor of Nassim, which seems to basically state the Rambam's position. The Avestor of Nassim says, in the context of that first mission in Pirkei Avos, this Yu Siag Torah, so says the Avestor of Nassim, Ezehu Siag, Sha'asa Sahatorah La'atzma, what's an example of a siyag that the Torah made for itself? Lo sikravu legalos eres. So we find that Alos Reb Nosson seems to be saying explicitly the Rambam's position that this is a case where the Torah created a safeguard for its own dinim and seems to not only exist but serve as the model for such things, as the representation of the idea that there is such a notion as a siyag d'oraisa. So this is what leads to this prohibition that's colloquially known as negia. Again, it really means chibuk v'nishuk barayis, leads to a whole discussion as to what exactly the parameters are. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, which is well known for its English words, about subways or buses, where he talks about sitting in cramped settings on subways and buses, and there he distinguishes between different types of contact. He writes that contact that's not sensual at all, that doesn't connect to anything along the path of Arayos, is not Asur Min HaTorah or Midrabanan. It's a question of what type of negi it is. And the Stechemba took a different approach. There are different angles to this, but that's all a part of the discussion, which emerges from this pasuk. Okay, so moving on to pasuk Yidches. So the pasuk talks about the prohibition of marrying two sisters. And here also, it's where we find some lack of parallelism in the Isuri Arayos, which is why there is, again, what do we still have to figure out about the nature of Arayos, because when it comes to brothers, so a wife is not allowed to marry two brothers, and clearly not at the same time, but even not at the same time. So let's say she's married to one brother, and she divorces that brother, she certainly can't marry the other brother. But even if the first brother dies, she can't marry the other brother. And that's why Yibum is such a chiddush, because that's what happens if there is Yibum, if there are no children. So then there's a mitzvah for the other brother to marry her, and the whole point, the whole discussion of the first part of Maseches Yibamos is that's essentially a overriding of a los aseh with an aseh, that there is an arayos there, but the mitzvah of Yibum overrides it. So this is different when it comes to sisters. So two sisters are not allowed to marry the same man. And that, again, that's also true even if the sister divorces the brother. So you still can't, the other sister can't marry, if the sister divorces her husband, the other sister can't marry that husband. So it doesn't matter, it's not at the same time. Even not at the same time, it's also prohibited. But not if the first sister dies. So that's what the pasuk says, b'chayeha. So if the first sister is no longer alive, then it's mutter to marry the second sister, and that's, again, a lack of parallelism between the dinim of brothers and sisters. So that's something that needs to be figured out, but in any event, in the context of the prohibition of marrying two sisters, so the Ramban here says that, you see, the pasuk gives you a reason, essentially. It says, l'tzror, that they should not, each one man should not take two sisters to be enemies with each other. That the assumption is that when one has more than one wife, so there is an inherent rivalry. It's not an ideal situation. And that's why the word for a co-wife in halachic literature, the Mormons call them co-wives and the Jews call them saros. They're considered to be opponents, rivals of each other. That's the language of the first Mishnah in Yevamos. So essentially what this pasuk is saying is that it's not right to make sisters into rivals. It's not right to take sisters who are supposed to have a natural love for each other and make them into enemies. So here, one could perhaps comment, I think there's some truth to this. Now, we know that it's a famous kasha that Rishonim, including the Ramban, ask about Yaakov Avinu. That if we have a tradition that the Avos kept Kol Torah Kula, so then the question is, how could Yaakov be married to two sisters? Isn't that a violation of the din? So how could Yaakov, observing the whole Torah, marry two sisters? So there are many different answers to this, and one approach is that this whole practice only was observed in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore Rachel had to die before going back in, many different approaches. I think one could say, it seems pretty reasonable to take the approach, that We say the Avos kept the Torah, so it's clear they were not commanded to keep the Torah. So how did they come to observe the Torah? So presumably they were on a level that, okay, they could figure out what the dinim of the Torah are, and therefore comply with them willingly. So it's one thing to say, all right, they're going to observe all of the dinim. But what about the rule that we have of Ein Dorshin in time of Dekra, that when it comes to our commandments, so we're not allowed to say that we think we know what the mitzvah is about, and therefore we can figure out kulas and chumras based on our theory of what the rule was meant to address. So as people who are commanded, so we're obligated to keep the mitzvahs, and we're not allowed to imply that, we're not allowed to assume that we know the reasons and we can apply the halacha accordingly. But if you're not commanded in the first place, and your whole involvement with mitzvos is because you are connecting to the reasoning, as presumably is the case with the avos, so I think it makes sense to say that the avos should not have had a prohibition of Ein Dorshin time of the Kra. That if they figured out the reasoning and the reasoning didn't apply in their case, it should have been mutter, perhaps by its nature. So if we want to say that the real isser of marrying two sisters is because they're going to be rivals to each other and they're going to be fighting, maybe there's a case to be made that Yaakov was able to ascertain that with Rachel and Leah there was such a bond of friendship between them, or at least that's the way it seemed. We see that Rachel gave the simanim to Leah, so she shouldn't be embarrassed when marrying Yaakov in the first place. So that type of cooperation indicates that there wasn't a nature of rivalry that was going to take place between them. So maybe he was Dairish Taima Dekra, Dairish Taima Dinan Kra, he doesn't have a pasuk yet. So maybe he had the right to be Dairish Taima and to decide that it should be Mutter. Perhaps that's a theory one could make based on this idea. Okay, we also find that there's also the prohibition of Nida that's mentioned here. It's an interesting question to what extent it's really included in this group. Because here we have all the arayos, so we have Nida as well. But Nida may or may not be an error, but there's a couple of sfekas that the Rishonim and the Achronim have about Nida. So one question is, does it belong together with the arayos? So what defines an erva? So one could say that an erva is defined by being a physical relationship that is prohibited by pain of karis. So if that's the case, okay, so Nida seems to fit those details. However, we could say that no, maybe that's not the whole story. Maybe that's not the definition of an erva. And maybe, like Rebbeinu Tam suggests in the beginning of Yivama Satosus, first off, Nivamas quotes Rebbeinu Tam along these lines, that maybe an erva is something that is fundamentally about the relationship between two people. Two individuals have a connection to each other that is prohibited, and that makes them arayos to each other. But a nida is prohibited to the whole world. So somebody whose prohibition is not based on the connection between her and someone else, maybe that's not called erva. That erva has to be a surah lazeh or mutaris lazeh. So that's how some understand. And that could have various nafkaminas. On one hand, maybe it has a nafkamina for the question of tfisas kedusha, that we normally assume that it's impossible to marry an erva. We had a discussion at the beginning of the year about the question of why is it impossible to marry an eishes ish. Maybe that's because of arayos, maybe that's because of the nature of the kinyan kedusha. So we normally assume it's impossible to marry an erva, so is it impossible to marry a nida? So that may have been a machlokus rishon. It sounds like from the Rambam that you can't have a chuppas nida halachically, it doesn't work. Well, we normally assume that it does work, it comes with a tremendous amount of halachic challenges, but we assume that kedushin are tofsa. There are various other nafkaminas as well. So this is a major question, whether Nida really is in the category of Gilarayos. So the fact that it's mentioned here, does that mean that that's its grouping, or is it something that has a thematic similarity, but isn't necessarily fully a part of that set? It's also a discussion whether there is a... It's a discussion in Rabbi Yosef Engel, in Asman Daraisa, where he quotes a Kuzari to this point, the question of whether there's any real relationship between the concept of Nida in Tumah Vatara and the Isser Nida Labayla? Do we say that that's a function of Tumah, or do we say that, no, there's two completely separate concepts in the context of Beis HaMikdash, so there is a notion of Tumah, and in the context of relationship to her husband, that's a whole different din. That's a matter of Isser. It doesn't have anything to do with Tumah Vatara. So there's a number of sfeikas as to how exactly to define the concept of Nidus as it comes up here. It's just worth noting. Here is another very mysterious concept that ends off the Aliyah and seems like it's completely out of nowhere. But perhaps not. And that's the concept of Molech. The idea of being Maver B'nol L'Molech, which appears also, we talked about it last year, because it appears in the next parsha, in Parshas Kedoshim, it appears in the Chamishi. You see, it's a tremendous synergy between these two parshios. So this is in Chamishi in Kedoshim, and it's in Shishi in Achrimos. So the idea of Molech is a very, very tricky concept. First of all, it's a machlokas in the Gemara, and it's a machlokas among the Rishonim also, whether Molech is actually out of Avodah Zarah. Is this an idolatry, or is this some other kind of shtick? The Ramban suggests that it's a type of kshafim, it was some kind of sorcery that was done. And the idea of being Madhur Vino, we also find a little bit of differences in language. That sound like you're sacrificing your son, or it sounds like from the Gemara and from elsewhere that they didn't actually sacrifice the son, they passed him through the fire. So, in any event, there's a lot of debate about this. The Sefer HaChinuch understood it to be that it was an Avodah Zarah. It's how he understood the Rambam, even though there's some debate about that. And that it says the Torah just singles it out, even though there already is a prohibition of Avodah Zarah, in order to say that this is gets extra severity because it was more prevalent of Avodah Zarah, and it was Avodah Zarah that was particularly egregious, so therefore it gets a separate mention, but it's just a part of the overall Avodah Zarah idea. And others understand it differently, and it's also interesting to note that this is something that Rav Hirsch comments on, that it's not really about Avodah Zarah in a very significant way, that Avodah Zarah represents somebody who abandons Judaism to take up idolatry. And here the point is that this is not really a full commitment to another religion, but it's something very different. It's something where you are still with one foot in the Beis HaMikdash, you're still also involved in trying to appease this other force of Molech. And in a sense, it's perhaps a little more dangerous because you're maintaining the connection to the Kodesh while doing this. And that, as he notes, explains the din, which is very baffling, that the Pasuk says, Mi Zaracha, that from your children you're not allowed to give, but not Kol Zaracha. So the idea that somehow you're off the hook from this din if you do this with all of your children, so that's a very difficult idea to understand. So some of the Bali Musar explain that it has to do with this idea of kind of trying to cover all your bases. You'll do a little for Molech, and a little for God, and maybe a little bit here, a little bit there, and in some sense of the word, that's either worse or it's different enough that it deserves to have its whole din here, and that's perhaps the point, and that's also how Rav Hirsch understands it, that that's consistent with this understanding that this person is not completely given over to Avodah Zarah, but rather he is a little bit here, a little bit there, and that's what Molech represents. Rav Hirsch goes on to suggest that this is not irrelevant to the whole process of the Arayos that we read about here, but this is consistent with the idea that if the whole notion of the Arayos is that we want to recognize that our relationships are Kodesh, that everything isn't just because what we want to do, but because it represents a mission in life and it's supposed to be sanctified. So that's true also of the result of that union. So you have a child. The child is not there to appease Molech. The child is there for a holy designated mission. And that's consistent with this context that we're meant to realize that that's a part of the message here as well. So that's why it comes in. So we'll just say a few words, not too much more, about the idea that all of these concepts are pretty much repeated in Parshas Kedoshim and Shishi of Kedoshim, really a very strong synergy, so we won't say so much about that. Again, we mentioned already Rav Hirsch's point that here the focus is different, that in the Achrimos it starts off addressing concepts of family relationships and saying it's inappropriate to turn those into physical relationships. And here in Kedoshim, we focus first on the sanctity of marriage. So he notes, and here perhaps he sees slightly contradictory indications, that when it talks about adultery, so the reference to Eshes Reyehu, so Rav Hirsch notes that the idea of emphasizing the word Reyehu here is a way to say that even if they're still Reyehu, that even if the man and the adulterer, the husband and the adulterer are still friends afterwards, in other words, to suggest that maybe the husband is okay with it, they have an open marriage, he doesn't object, so the point is, it doesn't matter. That's not something that is going to mitigate anything. This is an avera b'adam l'makom. This is not something which is up to an individual to be mofel on, and it's still going to be prohibited. But at the same time, as Ibn Ezra points out, that maybe the emphasis of Reyehu is also to say the opposite, is to remind us that this is an avera both b'adam l'makom and b'adam l'chaveru, and does tremendous damage both upstairs and downstairs. And you may recall that we spoke about this at some length, I think some months ago, talking about how the egregiousness of a extramarital affair exists on two levels, that it's an Aveira ben Adam l'Makom, and it is a very terrible Aveira ben Adam l'Chavero, and that any distinctions between the married man and the married woman in the Mamzerus issue, that relates to the Arayas concept that we find here, but as far as the Ben Adam L'Makom, so that there is no, Ben Adam L'Chavero, there's no distinction, and that's something which sometimes gets lost. It's crucial to remember that there is an equal violation on the Ben Adam L'Chavero level, whichever spouse it is having the affair, and it's a very, very terrible damage that inflicts on families and on society. And that's being emphasized here. So the Aliyah ends with the idea of lo saki, that you have to be careful to observe all these principles of Arayah so that the land will not eject you, the land will not throw you up, throw you out. So Rav Rivlin from Karen Biavna has a whole essay about this, a sefer on Chumash, where he brings proof from Rishonim and from other sources to indicate that you shouldn't think that this isn't literal, that the idea that the land can have an incompatibility, that an inanimate object can really feel that there is a kedusha that is not matching here, that is something which is not out of the realm of conception. It brings various proofs to that, various supports to that idea. But it's also important to note that the Netziv, in his commentary to Chumash, the Netziv says that Talmud Torah can offset this effect. Perhaps that's consistent with the Rambam's idea that Chachma and Arayos, in essence, are mutually exclusive, which is a little bit hard to understand how it works, but that's an idea that he and others have, that the more Chachma you bring in, the less room there is for Erva and its related activities, and that's perhaps what this Netziv is alluding to. And he notes also the Gemara in Adarim, which says, Alma of the Aretz, that the land was destroyed, according to Yirmiyahu HaNavi, Azam es Tarasi, that they left the Torah. So there he suggests that even though we know there are other Averos that we read about as the source for the Golos, but it could have been that would have been held in abeyance were it not for the fact that they abandoned the Torah. That's how he understands it. So therefore, here as well, that theoretically a greater commitment to the Torah can overcome it. So that's something we have to figure out exactly what that means, practically speaking. But both of these aliyahs really come together in a very clear way to emphasize, and perhaps this is synergistic also, with our constant themes that we find repeating each other. So clearly these two aliyahs very much parallel each other. But 2 weeks ago we read Shemini, and the Shishi of Shemini was about Kashrus. So we know that when the Rambam has, in his Mishneh Torah, he has the Sefer Kedusha. So Kedusha has in it Hilchos Yisuri Bia and Hilchos Machalos Asuras, essentially assuming a relationship that the rest of us probably would not have guessed between these two areas of halacha. Right, in Shulchan Aruch these are nowhere near each other, but in the Rambam these are grouped together. And the idea being that in all these areas of life, so we recognize that there is a distinction, that there is a discipline and a designation that comes along with sanctity, and that affects how we eat, that affects how we conduct our relationships, and all of that is being emphasized and re-emphasized in this context of Kedusha. Okay, so with that, we can take a few minutes to Chazer. So what's a good shorter topic to Chazer? Any suggestions? Otherwise, we'll just... Say again? So Arev is from the first half. Sorry? Talmud Torah is endless.
Is it minimal or maximal?
Right, all right, so I'll tell you what, we'll start it for a few minutes, and then we'll continue it, God willing, on Sunday. That's from the first half, which is theoretically on the test too, but you know, our priorities are...
I was thinking first half of the year.
No, first, this is from the first half of the semester, means that we chazer them before the midterm.
Yeah,
okay. So we can start Talmud Torah, and we could then pick it up on Sunday, and then we also could pick up Kitchen Advantage.